Thanks, David. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Matt Muse, hip-hop artist, going to be at Shuba's on Saturday night. More music in our performance studio, and we'll have a conversation with him as well. That's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Excited to hear more Matt Muse. Man, this kid's good. Well, a lot has been made to normalize mental illness in 2019, right? But as Jonathan Foyles writes in his new book, The City is Killing Me, we may have begun to normalize mental illness in individuals, but we haven't done anything about the environment people live in. We accept that individuals may be depressed, but what about whole communities? Jonathan is a therapist on the west side of Chicago, and he saw in his clients community trauma and toxic stress. When resources are limited and policies close institutions and facilities, what impact does all of that have on people? The book, again, is called The City is Killing Me, Community Trauma and Toxic Stress in Urban America. Jonathan Foyles, my guest on Extension 720 tonight. Jonathan, great to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great book. And you break this book down in this five different stories about patients that you serve, but you really kind of start by talking about mental health as we know it today, or how the facilities and institutions have really crumbled over time. Mm-hmm. You even give a little history lesson talking about it was the Kennedy administration that really started this country to recognize that there was a need for mental health in America.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, because Kennedy's sister herself had a mental illness and received what was a pretty common treatment at the time. They gave her a forced lobotomy.
Yeah, this is in the 40s, right?
Yeah. You know, and then she was pretty much unable to function for the rest of her life, spent the rest of her life in a nursing home. So I like to think that the impetus kind of started at home for Kennedy with that. So he wanted to create these community mental health centers, which is great, and he wrote a law to that effect, but it was a pretty toothless law. You know, nothing really happened. But what ended up happening instead is you had a lot of the advent of the psychiatric drugs that we know, a lot of the first generation ones. And they were harsh in a lot of ways, you know, a lot of them we don't use anymore because of side effects and whatnot. But they worked enough to stabilize people who beforehand would have just been kind of kept in institutions and let them live in the community. So that's good. You know, I mean, I think people do thrive best in the community. But what you had is a very rapid pace of deinstitutionalization without creating the resources to match the need that we were creating in the community.
Right.
You know, so you had a lot of you know, budget cuts in terms of these like large state mental hospitals and institutions that used to exist. I mean,
decade after decade, administration after administration, national and local. Every time it came to budget time, they're like, well, let's take a little bit more off of mental health.
Yeah, and it's not a left or a right thing. You know, I mean, I think both parties have been equally bad at it. You know, and I think it's just kind of been something, you know, that's been a very convenient the thing that cut, you know, the amount, you know, there's a staggering amount that was cut from state mental health budgets following the recession, you know, and none of that money's been replaced.
Right.
And you
see it, and obviously in Chicago, we've heard a lot about this with the former mayor Emanuel, who came in, and one of the first things he did is say, there's just no money for mental health clinics in Chicago. And, you know, at this point, if you got insurance, good for you. If not, there's one place.
Yeah. You know, and the line they gave is that, you know, these patients would be absorbed by clinics in the community. But, you know, that assumes that, you know, there are all of these places ready to accept people with open arms.
Like private places,
Were that were true. But, you know, the private places that exist, you know, are already, you know, understaffed and overbooked. You know, there was that scare a few years ago where C4, which is one of the big community counseling centers in Chicago, almost closed. And they ended up, you know, being saved in what I understand is a more limited capacity. And all you had to save some money. The highest estimate I've seen that it could have saved was $3 million, which is, you know, in terms of the budget for the city of Chicago, I think it was like $8 billion that year. You know, it's just dropping.
What blows my mind about this, too, is that your book really does a great job of pointing out all of the toxic stress and stress that's on communities in Chicago. And that could play, you break it down into the categories. But
yeah.
But, you know, that could be anything from safety and violence to poverty to defunding resources for not just mental health clinics, but for institutions like schools.
I mean,
we had the biggest closing of public schools in American history just within this decade. So when you put all that stuff together, there almost feels like there's more need for mental health clinics because of all of these stresses. Why don't governments and leaders recognize that there is that need? Is it just at the end of the day, there's just not enough dollar to stretch?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that is a good question. And I think, you know, I think in some ways we lack a sort of broad picture thinking when it comes to that. And I think because to really think in a systems way about that would force us to confront a lot of things that we struggle to confront, you know, redlining, the history of racism in Chicago and every major city, you know, the things that have happened to make these communities so, you know, economically poor and poor in other ways, you know, and I think it would force us to ask some really hard questions of ourselves, you know, and so I think we just don't do it, you know.
When you were in your practice on the West Side, mm-hmm. when you were having patients, when did you recognize that it was more than just the individual?
You know, I think it just started from realizing how different a lot of patients' experiences was from mine. Because certainly, you know, I see patients who I treat specifically for trauma and then others who have anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder. But even the ones who, you know, it's not trauma. You know, I can think of one woman in particular who, you know, just very depressed, doesn't really get out of the house much, you know. So I was, you know, one of the things you learn in grad school, one of the things that helps a lot of people is to get outside more, go for a walk, you know, get some fresh air. And so I suggested that once to her without really thinking about it. And then she's just like, yeah, so there's a drug dealer who's across the street from my apartment. I've seen him get shot 3 times. Yeah. She's like, I am not going out there.
No, and that's a lot of the stories that you recognize is that the basic tenets of your American life, mm-hmm. right? If you're yeah. going to look at the white picket fence and mm-hmm. we're going to walk around, just even that, go outside and get some fresh air, yeah. is not enjoyed by certain communities in this country.
No. And I don't think that our current mental health ideas, you know, therapies are really designed to deal with that in full yet. I mean, one, because you know, some of that is beyond the scope of what you can do in individual therapy, you know. But also, I think because, you know, a lot of therapists look like myself, they're, you know, white, middle class or upper middle class, and we design therapies to treat people who look like us. And so we don't really think about some of these structural issues. Yeah.
It's a great book because you really do almost by chapter lay out 5 different cases mm-hmm. of 5 different patients. At the beginning of the book, you talk about, and it's a really great example, and I want mm-hmm. to share this example, but mm-hmm. you take two names, Michael mm-hmm. and Thomas.
Yeah.
And this is really the basics mm-hmm. of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Two kids, let's say that they're both being bullied at school, and you can pick it up from there. But the idea that that's really, Michael and mm-hmm. Thomas have the same experience at school, they're both being bullied.
Yeah. You know, so you take Michael, you know, Michael gets bullied at school, he goes home, you know, his grandmother's his caregiver, you know, his grandmother sits him down, makes him a snack, she asks him how his day was, he tells her, you know, she may not have any, you know, massive suggestions or things to help, but she listens. You know, she says, hey, how about I talk to that teacher tomorrow? You know, tucks him in, he goes to sleep. And so he came home and his arousal level was maybe at like a 10, you know, and it dropped. And so what that means is, you know, when he goes to school tomorrow, he'll be feeling okay. You know, that bullying experience, you know, may have left its mark, you know.
There's a cause and effect, or there's this idea that there's anxiety and there are ways to treat anxiety.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And, you know, and ways that don't even require someone like me.
Right,
you know,
right,
it's require
right. a just basic stuff.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, but then if you have a kid like Thomas, who same thing, gets bullied, comes home, you know, his parents aren't home because they have to work longer hours. So there's a neighbor that kind of keeps her eye on him, but isn't really a caregiver. So he, you know, makes a sandwich for himself and watches TV. You know, his parents get home, dad starts drinking, they start fighting. He goes to his room. You know, unlike Michael, where he had these sort of a restful experience, so his arousal level could drop. You know, Thomas just keeps ratcheting up.
He never got to download and say what happened at school.
No,
right.
You know, and then when he goes to school tomorrow, he's going to be feeling worse. You know, and the way that stress like that works is it just builds and builds and builds over time. You know, and you see it in mental health, but you see it in physical health too. You know, kids, you know, like Thomas have, you know, hypertension, diabetes, you know, even cancer and stuff like that. You know, the stress just. You know, it's hard on you.
And what I love about it, too, is if you pull back, and we know Michael and Thomas as names of in this scenario, boys.
Yeah.
But you pull back and you say, what if that wasn't a boy? What if that was a community? Mm-hmm. What if that was happening?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, those are two different disparate communities
happening
in two different places in the Chicagoland area.
Yeah.
And you can understand why toxic stress and community stress plays a bigger role in one area than mm-hmm. another.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It's a great book. This City is Killing Me, Community Trauma and Toxic Stress in Urban America. Jonathan Foiles is my guest tonight in Extension 720. We're talking about it. We'll take a break, come back, and more on Extension 720. So stay with us. It's Extension 720 here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Jonathan Foiles is in studio with me tonight. He's the author of This City is Killing Me, Community Trauma and Toxic Stress in Urban America, therapist on the West Side of mm-hmm. Chicago. had an opportunity to see this firsthand, and you sort of profile five different patients, mm-hmm. and you change the names and change everything.
Yeah,
this is not something that, you know, is straight up somebody's story. Mm-hmm. Why go about it this way? Why tell your story and mm-hmm. what you've found from your practice through the actual patients?
Yeah, I mean, I think for one reason, it's kind of how I encountered the issues, you know, or like, you know, I read about it in paper and stuff, but it's what really brought it home to me. And I think that just the way that human minds work, you know, it's hard to grasp these big, large concepts like the closing of the mental health clinics, you know. Most of us don't know a patient that was impacted by that just because our lives are structured right. in such a way that we don't really encounter them. You know, and I think you can say a number like, oh, you know, 3,000 patients, whatever, were impacted. But if you put a name to it, if you just describe the smallest bit of their experience, I think it just helps kind of these concepts and these things that have happened in Chicago that we know about and that we feel concerned about. It gives a face to them.
It really does. And, you know, you hit it on the head, this idea of defunding or closing mm-hmm. institutions like mental health clinics
yeah.
or like the schools that mm-hmm. were closed in Chicago. We may not have people who you can point to and say, oh, I was affected by that.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
I could tell you A, B, C, how this changed my life. Mm-hmm. You know, like that may not be at your grasp.
Yeah.
But when you look at the combination of all these things, and then you include some of the other factors when it comes to communities, and even the history that you have to take into account when it comes to mass incarcerations mm-hmm. and the Jim Crow laws
yeah.
and other things
yeah.
like that, you start to see this pattern of why there's a need for mental health in these communities.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, we think about trauma on the individual level a lot, and of course, I mean, we should, but I think we don't think about the way that it can just grow and sort of, fester in communities over time, you know, because it's, you know, you think about the history of African Americans, and you go from slavery to brief period of Reconstruction, and then Jim Crow laws and lynching, you know, and then, you know, the burst of the civil rights movement, and then, you know, the sort of erosion of voting rights since then, you know, and all of that, you know, impacts individuals along the way, but it also just creates these narratives and creates these stories within families, within communities of, you know, we don't matter, you know, we aren't the people that, you know, these institutions, these, you know, laws are have in mind or are mm-hmm. designed to protect, you know.
Yeah, it makes me think too, and unfortunately I'm grasping at what the name of the documentary I think was watching, or we mm-hmm. did something before, Pete and I did something on Extension 720. But this idea that, you know, the effect of walking past a school that's been boarded up,
yeah,
that you live next to, mm-hmm. that you're a block away from,
mm-hmm.
and then you walk to the other corner and the grocery store that once stood is not there,
mm-hmm.
The clinics, the doctors,
yeah.
everything is not there.
Yeah.
And there may be remnants of that,
mm-hmm.
meaning that you see the building with the, you know, in the case of schools, you
yeah.
see it with the boarded up windows.
Yeah.
And the effect it has on somebody, and not just somebody, but the community.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I think what it creates is you just can turn around every corner and just receive the message like, oh, we don't count. You know, we're not objects of investment for businesses, for the city, you know. And I think, too, a lot of these institutions, you know, the schools, the, you know, mental health centers, even stores and, you know, shops and stuff like that, they create these third places where neighbors can encounter one another. You don't even have to talk to each other, but just realizing like, oh, the same woman checks me out every week, you know, it just creates a little bit more buy into your community. You know, it's just one more face that you know.
Right.
And even if you never talk to them, it just creates a sense of communal belonging. And when you strip all those places away, you just have a lot of people living in an area with no real means to connect to one another, and no, you know, which further decreases their resources if they do find themselves in crisis.
Yeah.
Like, who are they going to talk to?
Well, I think with your book, Jonathan, and what I really gravitated towards
mm-hmm.
was this idea that you hear this, you heard it on the mayor, on the mm-hmm. mayoral campaign trail mm-hmm. when we were about this idea that you need to invest in communities, you know,
mm-hmm.
we have to get to the root causes of some of the things that are ailing our communities, like violence and poverty. And that's all, you could say that all day. So
mm-hmm.
what do you mean investment?
Yeah.
We're going to bring a couple Best Buys down there? What are we
yeah.
talking about?
Yeah.
And when you read that the effect it has, and you
mm-hmm.
see here, and you can even make it draw a line to violence numbers and the corollary to closing schools or closing mental health clinics, and you do that in the book, you start to get a better understanding of what that means when you say we need to reinvest in the community. It's not about small businesses lining the street necessarily, but it's about sort of respecting the institutions for some of these areas, regardless of the poverty level.
Yeah, and just creating an overall narrative that, you know, these communities are worth investing in, you know, that we as fellow Chicagoans, you know, as people, as human beings, you know, prioritize the sort of things that make a community tick.
Now that you have been working on the west side of Chicago and you've been able to put this book together and you continue being a therapist there, have you changed your approach or at least your understanding of what your patients are going through based on collecting all this information for this book?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think I've definitely grown in my understanding. You know, I think, you know, I've told people, I don't really think if my patients were to read the book, it may sort of systematize some stuff for them, but I don't think they would be like, oh, I never thought of that, you know, because they live it.
They live it,
right. You know, so I think it's helped me gain, increase my understanding of them and what they experience. And I think, you know, therapy ideally is a process of you kind of learning from your patients. And I think that can be the contours of their individual story. But I think it's also, you know, sort of these outside forces that have shaped their life just as much as the inside forces they have.
If it's not for your patients and people who necessarily live in these communities because they live it, who's it for? Who's the book for? Is it for people like me who are like, I'm trying to figure out why these things happen and trying to connect the dots?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I had kind of in mind like somebody who cares but wants to know more. You know, and I've noticed that, you know, even family, close friends I have, they know what I do, you know, they, you know some of the realities of my day to day, but in my writing in the book especially, but in other stuff I've written, they're like, oh, this really gives me a sense of what you do and how hard it can be. And I thought I was already communicating that. So I think for me, it was just kind of like a moment too of realizing like, oh, I don't think people get what this all really means. You know, they don't have a face.
And I was going to say, I mean, you can go into therapy in your life and you can talk about different things and trauma that might have happened in your life. But I mean, some of the in situations that are laid that you lay out with your patients, this is trauma that the minute you see your eyeballs kind of you know, come out of your face just because of the idea that this is stuff that you can't fathom that people deal with.
No. There's definitely I think for a lot of clinicians when they start out, because I also run the intern program, so I see a lot of them kind of coming in mostly, you know, wide-eyed, really eager to please. And there's always this like, wow, you know, moment that they all experience when they realize, you know, I think one, how much trauma people have experienced, but also just how pervasive it is. You know, whenever I interview new clients, one of the things we address is sort of their traumatic experiences in the past. And I've found the number of times that it's a full no for this list is incredibly rare, you know, and frankly, it's at a point now where if people are saying no, I just think like, oh, they're probably not ready to talk about it yet, you know, rather than like, oh, nothing happened to them.
Right. Well, it's a fascinating book. It's called This City Is Killing Me, Community Trauma and Toxic Stress in Urban America. The author is Jonathan Foyles. Jonathan, great to meet you, and look forward to this being applied in some form, but also love to have you back at some point and continue the conversation.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in.
Great. Thanks.